Hello and welcome to the Game Dev London podcast, a community of amazing people who love talking about and sharing their love for the details behind making games, whether or not they're actually in London. I'm your host. I'm Oscar Clark, he, him pronouns, and I'm here on a quest to understand everything you wanted to know about game dev, but never dared to ask. Today, I am joined by Steve Bromley, and I'm going to bring him on screen. Steve, how are you doing? You're a user, game user researcher, and it turned out we have some mutual connections in the history of games user research. Do you want to introduce yourself and tell everybody what you do?
Yeah, of course. And thank you for the wonderful introduction. So my name is Steve Bromley. I am a games user researcher, which I have been doing in the games industry for over a decade now. As you mentioned, the games industry is a very small place, isn't it? So you bump into the same people again and again, and it's always a good idea to be on your best behaviour because of that. What does the games user researcher do? So, as you know, playtesting is a really essential part of how everyone makes games. Lots of developers and designers and people make sure that playtesting is an integral part of how they're making games. What we do as games user researchers is we bring in some best practice from UX and from science to structure those playtests better and make sure that we are confident that we are running sensible experiments, learning reliable results, and getting the type of quality information that you need to make all those essential game design decisions that our developers, our designers, our producers, our artists need to do their job well.
I think that's really interesting. I mean, particularly one thing I think is interesting about applying the science of understanding how to test is that the influence of observer factors. I don't want to get all quantum physics because it's nothing to do with that, but there is some truth in the fact that if you know that I am watching you while you're playing, it's going to impact your behavior. And I think when we look at playtesting, there's a massive difference between us playing the game with somebody else to see how it experience, you know, how the experience plays, particularly with board game design and card game design and stuff like that. And when you're dealing practically with observing what a real player might do with that game. Do you want to expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, I think that's a really sensible point. And obviously, as you say, when you're aware you're being observed, your behavior is going to change. And that's something that as user researchers, we're really aware of. If we're bringing people into usability labs, there's a whole bunch of steps we take to try and minimize that effect, but it still exists. And so you have to combine it with other ways of gathering information on players' behavior, looking at analytics, looking at telemetry, looking at their post-launch behavior is really important. Another side of this as well, though, is that observer effect is magnified tenfold if you are the one who made the game. If the player thinks, oh, I'm playing in front of the designer who made it and they're really proud of what they made and they're showing me something they're really proud of, they're not going to be honest. Both on a conscious level, they're going to hold back. And also unconsciously, that's going to change how you feel and make your opinions and your behavior not really represent what we'd see in the real world with people who don't know you personally. That's why,
I think it's also part of that is really interesting. In my experience is that some people will become ultra critical because they think that's what you want to hear, whereas others will be ultra complimentary because they don't want to offend you. And I think it's a very much a personality thing. So you can't even say, oh, I'll just dial the knob down a bit. Is that true in your experience?
I think that's really sensible, yes. And that is one of the challenges of... So another part of the role, obviously, I could talk a lot about different parts of the role in a minute, but one part of the role is that actual moderation, being with a player in the room, being able to get high quality feedback back from them. And one of the challenges we see is that players... It's not a very natural situation for players. They think they're there to do a job. They don't understand that what we really want is you just to be a real player. Just do what you really would at home. Don't do anything different. But they think they're expected to impress us or to give negative feedback because we're after negative feedback. And again, that's the type of bias we want to be avoiding.
And often they're being paid to attend for their time. I mean, not a lot of money. We're talking about 20, 40, 50 quid, something like that. But it's common to do that because that's a necessary step to separate their kind of you are just somebody to you are a research subject and we are valuing your time. And again, I think that shows a different... I mean, we probably want to take a little bit of a step back because
yes,
I think that there is a bunch of things going on when we're trying to understand what, I mean, let's face it, what we're trying to do is find the fun. Mm-hmm. But we're trying to find the fun in a number of clarified ways. So find the fun in a commercial structure that is scalable, that is engaging, that is retaining, all these kind of different factors. And each game is going to have a different balance of what it's trying to find out. Mm-hmm. If you're starting this process off, what's the first thing you think a game developer needs to think about?
Yeah, that's a great question. So one of the ways that we start with the teams we work with is by making them recognize that their ideas, whether they're a designer, an artist, or whatever their creative role is, should be treated as a hypothesis. You think that players are going to understand what you're presenting to them and they're going to react in the way you want, whether that's they're going to have fun, whether it's going to be a sad moment, get the type of emotional response you're expecting. But until you validate that, you don't know if your hypothesis is true or not. You don't know if players are going to misunderstand or not be able to do it or have other usability or comprehension issues that you couldn't imagine. One of the
Let's dig in a little bit into the word hypothesis, though, because I think there is a genuine scientific method going on here. And a hypothesis isn't just I've got an idea. Mm-hmm. To me, a hypothesis is something which is disprovable. Mm-hmm. And I think, one of the things that I think is difficult to get right when you think about design is that we need to find ways and angles and avenues where we can accept the truth of a failure. Mm-hmm. And I think part of that is setting an expectation of what success looks like before you run the test. Just what it is to test, but how you measure that test and what is the threshold below which isn't good enough or needs change.
I think that's exactly it. So coming back to your question about the first point, really the first point is that objective setting with teams, understanding what their design intent is, what they're trying to achieve, understanding what success or failure looks like. And then that raw information, a user researcher can take away and we can design a study around that. We can say, okay, let's test that. Let's understand if you are getting the response and the success measures that you're expecting from what you're putting in front of players. It's quite a rigorous process because we're trying to be scientific and take on that UX best practice.
Yeah.
But I think that's one of the advantages that we add compared to informal playtesting where people just want to see what people think, but they haven't pre-thought about the hypothesis or what success looks like. It's adding rigor to that process.
I think it does. I think that rigor is so critical, but I think there's also other aspects to it, because quite a lot of the things we want to do, we can't just sit there and go, right, so there's a checklist of yeses, so you do these things and then that equals fun. I don't think a checklist equals fun. Mm-hmm. As much as I'd like that to be that easy, sadly, I don't think it is. My feeling is, though, this is one of the reasons why I think we need to, for those who don't understand the difference, can I get you to qualify the difference between a qualitative process, which is largely what we're talking about, and a quantitative process, which is generally more statistical based. Do you want to kind of explain that to people?
Yes, so user researchers have a range of methods that they draw upon to answer their questions, and depending on the type of question that the team has at the time, we'll pick the right method. Some of those methods are what we call qualitative, which is often very rich, deep data based on observing players and what their behavior is, listening to what players are saying, looking at players' understanding and seeing what they understand and they don't understand. And that kind of depth data is really important for making change, to see if you're getting the right kind of emotional response from your game you expect and making the right kind of changes. In contrast, some of the other questions we get are what we call quantitative questions, largely ones about measurement. So other types of questions you might get asked include, is the difficulty of this game correct? Are players leveling up at the level we expect? What's the churn rate in this game? And those type of things you want to measure things to find the answer to, whether that's measuring players' sentiment, getting them to rate things on a rating scale, whether that's measuring the number of times they fail on a challenge, whether it's measuring how long they're in the game before they churn and they leave the game. Those type of things we'll want to do quantitative type of measures for. And again, one of the skills that we bring as user researchers is we'll take your vague research objectives, we'll flesh them out, and then we'll combine them with the right method so that you're finding the right kind of data to give you, to allow you to make better informed decisions, which is ultimately what we're trying to do, improve your decision making as a designer.
No, exactly. And I think this is the, again, let me give you one of the quandaries I often get when I try to explain testing to people. It's when I'm doing something like we do a lot of online user testing. You know, we use teams like Playtest Cloud or Antistargress or others. The reason being is we want to eliminate our involvement. We want to facilitate, and it's frankly cheaper. It's not necessarily as good as in person for lots of reasons, but it has its own advantages. But when I often get asked is, why are you only doing five or six people?
That's a great question. And yeah, we, again, you hear that all the time, because the assumption is, well, it's only five or six people, but how can that be reliable? What if these are the five wrong people, or these are five weird people who have weird opinions? Again, it comes down to what are the type of questions you want answered. So that stats you might hear about learning things from five players is usually focused on discovering usability issues.
Yes.
And some academic work that has been done in the past by people like Nielsen and Norman, they found out when they did a big meta review that when you've seen five users of one audience do something, you've identified 85% of the most significant usability issues.
Exactly.
Now, that's a usability issue is different from an opinion. It's not found out 85% of the opinions about this game, or whether 85% of people will like this game or not. You've just discovered 85% of the problems about understanding your game. And we think that's a good time to make some fixes. So you could go on and you could see 10 users, 15 users, and move from 85% of the problems to finding 90% or 95% of the problems. But for return on investment, it's probably a good idea, once you've found 85% of the problems, let's have a go at fixing those, and then to get the next five users to see if we have fixed them, and also see what problems were obscured by those problems last time that have now been revealed. So yeah, again, it comes down to picking the right method for the type of questions you have about your game, which is an art and a skill.
Exactly. Science, folks. But I mean, I think that's absolutely key to it, though, for me, which is it's understanding that no test is perfect. No test is going to give you the here's everything you need to do in one go. Job done. Thank you very much. Wrap it up there. Let's move on and ship it. If only. And in fact, actually, I'd argue that games are best as living experiences, which are constantly being updated throughout their entire lifetime over years. But then I'm biased because I wrote a book on games as a service. But the point for me is that I think you've hit the nail on the head. It's like, understanding what problems a test is trying to solve. Again, why we choose to have a hypothesis that's testable, that's failable, and we understand what the KPIs are, that what good looks like, and then we conduct that test, and we do get outliers. You know, we do get weird people playing the game, you know, especially if we do a good job, and I mean that, of recruiting in an unbiased way. And frankly, the language I often use is that truth is an uncomfortable thing we've got to learn to embrace. In fact, we've got to learn to love to embrace is the important thing there. You know, imagine this kind of massive, you know, pointy, sharp, random object that you've got to hug onto. And I think you get close to why I love user research. That sounds really weird. We've talked a little bit there about, so where comes the point where statistical significance is meaningful? Where's that balancing act between the usability quant kind of test and the statistically significant quantitative? So where is the statistically significant quant style coming to a force?
I will answer that, but there were so many interesting points you made on the lead up to that that I'll get to that.
Yeah.
I really like your point about recognizing that game development is an iterative process.
Yeah.
That's obviously a lot more pertinent and obvious when you're doing games as a service, because you have a launch version and then you're iterating on your launch version. But that's very much still the case on a boxed game or a release game, because throughout that development process, teams are iterating on the core mechanics, iterating to find the fun, and then iterating on throughout the production stage to create the final thing, which kind of leads on to, when do you want to move from qual to quant? Although, again, ultimately, it depends on what the team want to know at that time. There is a general shape of these things where early on, when the team is trying to iterate and find the fun, often it's very hard for them to define those hypotheses at that stage because you don't know until you've done some archaeology and some digging to know what you're trying to make until you've explored that. And so often teams will start at that stage with very informal playtesting, perhaps not using all this rigor and the science that we've been talking about, until they've worked out what it is they want to make. And then you'll move into a more formal qualitative research of, we think we understand what emotional impact we're trying to have from players, and we think what we're trying to convey to players, but we need that kind of depth of understanding about if they're getting it or not and why they're getting it or not to make the substantial design changes needed. Later in development, as you start to come to late in alpha or beta, you do want to then start moving to the quant questions when you're trying to balance things or design things. So that is when questions about difficulty or balance or progression rates come up. And so, yeah, I guess if you're going to draw a general shape, you want to start really informal until you find out what you want to do, structured qualitative playtesting early in production, and larger quant studies later in production. But although that's a general shape of it, that things jump all over the case. Teams come up with questions at different points, right?
And absolutely, I think the thing in my head is you test as early as possible and you test with real people as soon as possible. But that doesn't mean you can't sit there with your designer mate and effectively role play the role of the target player and try to guess what that would be like. It's nowhere near the same level of response as when you get somebody who's not connected to you, but it's still indicative and still helps you form your hypothesis. And as I actually find that qualitative research allows me to work out what quantitative analysis I want to do. So for example, I'll often go, right, what did you feel about this game? And then later I'll do a larger survey for a larger audience where I go, these feelings or these responses I got in the user testing, how many of you feel like this? So now I've got hard data based on large volumes of people, but the questions were written by the people who did the softer testing. Not quite, but does that make sense?
That mixed method approach sounds really valuable and is a really important part of it. I also really like your point about designers role-playing and trying to embody the role of a player. Obviously, that's a learned skill and takes practice and takes being exposed to real players to develop. But it is hugely valuable to get a head start on what players might experience in your game. Obviously, players are always surprising and players are very different to us. If we're working on a game, I'm thinking about that game 24/7. I know how all the systems work. I don't need a tutorial. I know what bits are finished and what bits are not finished. And so it's really difficult to get that beginner's mindset that you get from a real player. But practicing that skill is super important and valuable.
To me, it's a bit like editing your own work. If you're if you're a writer or an artist, or a video producer, you can't really be the person editing it. That's why I think when you go back to a novel or go back to a game design 6 months, 9 months later, you find all the problems because you've got distance. Whereas, you know, if you're somebody else, that automatically gives you a level of distance. And again, maybe there's something in that distance question that putting it in front of somebody who's more like the person who's going to be paying for this. Because that's the other thing. It's like, we may be working on this thing, but we're hoping to get paid from it. That's a very different emotion from somebody who's having to pay out for that experience. And that's a completely different spectrum of thinking in my head.
That's one of the ways I see teams go wrong when they're doing playtesting themselves. And one of the most impactful things, I think, if teams want to fix one thing to work on, is that recruiting the right kind of player. The type of people who play your games, about all you know about them is they play games like this and they buy games like this. And so you should be using those sort of criteria to make sure you're finding the right kind of players. Yeah. Otherwise, you're learning behaviours and opinions of people who are not going to buy your game. And ultimately, what's the point of that?
Precisely. So let's talk about that, recruitment. Now, obviously, one of the things I think I said earlier is I don't want to be the one recruiting because I think that inherently adds bias. Mm-hmm. What should people be thinking about when they're recruiting testers?
Yes. So one of the ways that teams often misstep the team might make is focusing very heavily on demographics. Mm. You might imagine, okay, I can imagine someone who plays my game. They're going to be 18-year-old and they're going to be male and they're going to live in the southeast of England. And some of that may be true, but it's a really easy trap to fall into stereotypes and not really get into the core of what makes your players by working on that way. Instead, what we recommend is, well, first trying to define your players, think about those questions such as what types of games are they playing currently? Where are they buying games? How often do they play games? Those type of criteria that will make them your type of player by looking at other games they play in the same genre or other things you expect them to have played. Then, well, I'm very lucky in that many of the projects I work on, we work with an external participant recruiter where we can just give them a spec that says, we want 18 people who have played the last Halo game so they can come and play test, for example, the next Halo game.
Yeah, yeah.
And they go and do all the hard work. But lots of teams don't have the budget or the ability to do that. Instead, it then becomes quite a hard job of working out where do these players hang out? Where do they exist? Mm-hmm. Looking at communities, which, again, has some downsides. The type of people who hang out on the forums for your game or for competitor games are often more hardcore than a typical player of these titles. But with care, you can use outreach to try and find these players, build a panel of players that you can bring in for playtests, and then bring them in based on those criteria that you've designed for your players.
And I think there are some pros and cons to various approaches. So, for example, at those earlier stages, when I'm using something like... So the way we, as a publisher, when we bring a game on board, we do a CPI test. What that means is we do a 30-second trailer, and we see how much it would cost for somebody to click a download button. Now, sometimes that'll be to an actual download, sometimes that'll be to a fake web page, but we're effectively synthesizing the willingness for a random audience of Facebook kind of people. We use Facebook, if anyone's wondering, because it happens to have the ability to target very effectively at very low cost. There are very few other platforms that can actually do that, sadly. I'd like there to be more, I'd like there to be more options, but that's where we are. It's really effective at finding a market-like audience and seeing their willingness to click on a button. It doesn't do much more than that. There used to be a lot more possibilities because you could be very sub-level targeting, but obviously with data protection, that's become a little bit less finessed. Let's put it that way. So that's a useful way of getting randomized individuals because you can say, I want to have, like you said, they play this kind of game, I quite like demographics to an extent, but I like stereotypes to an extent, but you can't just say against player is an 18 to 24 year old male because that's not true anymore. 80% of over 50s who regularly use the internet, according to Hootsuite, identify as gamers. Something like, actually maybe slightly less than that, but it's that order of magnitude.
Yeah.
So we can't just be lazy anymore. We've got to look at what actual game subgenres demographics actually are and use them as personas. If you're going to take that route, I like that route.
That's really nice.
As long as you are actually defining a real audience as far as possible with the available information and that you update that persona as you learn more information. And I think that's really key. It's like you can make hypotheses. Again, it's a hypothesis what your demographic is. We create a persona, so we give that individual a name. We do choose gender sometimes, and not always. We do pick age groups mostly, just for our own shorthand. And then we use that information to help us to make design decisions and goals because we can role play in that personality and that cultural context.
Again, I really like how you've described an iterative process. So as you say, yes, definitely start with that and then there are opportunities to develop that understanding, aren't there? Because if you're bringing someone in to playtest, you could also talk to them as part of that playtest about their motivations for playing games, their behavior around game playing, and again, develop your understanding of who your players are to more depth.
Exactly. I know that's exactly what we're trying to do. Now, there's another kind of test that we do, which is what we call an NPS test. It's called an NPS test because we're using a tool like a Playtest Scatter Antidote or User Brain or whatever the platforms are. Anyway, what we're doing is we're getting a recruitment from a panel, essentially, of willing players of games. So they're already professionalized. They're already established players. Now, that would be a negative, as you described earlier. But as long as we know that, we can take that into account in their responses to a certain extent. But it's actually really useful at an early stage because what we're looking for that audience is the ultimate question in research or market research in general, which is, would you recommend to a friend? That phrase is known under the colloquial term net promoter score. And from a marketing point of view, that is an incredibly valuable, in fact, it's probably the most valuable number other than day one retention. In fact, probably the most valuable number is repeat purchase. I'll get to that another point, but let's leave that for now. One of the many most valuable numbers is net promoter score. So again, what I'm trying to describe there is that I think that there's different slices and flavors of these kind of usability tests that serve different functions, but they form a picture. It's a bit for me like having different cameras with different zoom settings. There's no point in using the macro lens until you've got it pointed at the right thing. So you might start off with, it's a terrible analogy, apologies for that. You might start off with a wide angle lens so you get the full picture, and then you might have a telephoto lens to zoom into a particular part of that picture. But until you then know where you're aiming, you don't want to get the macro lens out because you're just going to get a blur.
I think that's really, again, I speak to a lot of teams about playtesting, and you've definitely touched on, we've talked about a couple of the mistakes that teams make, but that is another mistake, is picking the method first and deciding, okay, we're going to run a survey for our players, same as we're going to use the macro lens for our players, without having done that first step to think about, actually, what do you want to learn from them? What are our objectives? And using that to inform the decision about your camera lens or your method, rather than starting with the method.
And I think it's also a question we've got to ask. I mean, the elephant in the room is that this has costs associated with it. And obviously, the scale of the game is going to impact your availability or the usefulness of some of the levels of detail to go into. You know, if you've got an indie game that's going to sell 10,000 copies, that's very different from an online service provided by the console platform that's going to be played by 40 million people. I say that having been on PlayStation Home, where we had around 40 million people download the game. We had about 3 million monthly actives. So at that scale, because we were the platform and our job was to show what the platform could do, we had the remit and scope to be able to do that kind of testing. We were able to do biometric level testing. Not very often, to be honest. Not as often as I'd like. But to get people in a room with a sweat test and a heart rate monitor and facial recognition, although, to be honest, the facial recognition at the time was very, very early. It was a long time ago. How far can this testing go that's useful, would you say?
Yes, you've touched on a point that's been on my mind for the last year, that you could spend infinite amount of budget on testing. You can buy a super high-tech lab, all the big publishers do. You can do extensive amount of quant testing that often gets very expensive. But for a lot of game developers, that isn't accessible. If you are a small team, if you've got under five staff, you're all very busy, have no time. All of this stuff sounds lovely in theory, but it's really hard to prioritize.
Yes.
I spent the last year interviewing teams of that size to understand the problem better, because I think there's a lot of that best practice that we can take from the scientists doing this on that big level to make it accessible for these smaller teams, without getting too much of an advert. what I've been doing recently is putting together guides and templates aimed at those small teams, and I'm soon to release the playtest kit, which hopefully brings some of that best practice from the big publishers, but cuts it down, cuts corners in the bits where it's safe to cut corners, keeps the bits that are really essential and really important to make accessible to teams who have no budget or no time. Although ultimately, I know we've talked a lot about picking the right methods. I think teams should be surprised about how much they're going to learn just by watching some people play their game. Yeah. Super informal, super reasonably easy to run. Just putting some players in front of your game, not biasing them, being open to hear and to observe their experience. I think for a lot of teams, just that small thing can be revelationary to them.
Oh, it's an interesting one because one of my bugbears is people using game events. Now, obviously, the last couple of years, that's not really been happening. But historically, you would go to PAX or a Rez or something, and you have people play your game, and they'd tell you how great it was. And you think, great, I've got some feedback that's useful. That's not useful at all. Absolutely, completely useless. Mm-hmm. Is that inevitably bad, or are there techniques where we could actually get value out of that?
Yeah, so as you've observed, there are a lot of issues with that kind of data. You haven't recruited your participants particularly well, so you're not sure if they're your players. You've put them in a situation that isn't like what they're really going to be playing the game. They're not really going to be playing the game in front of 10 people in a booth, are they? And they're also not going to have the developer watching them, telling them, oh, if you get stuck on this bit, this is the button you need to press as they play. So the immediate read is that type of data isn't very valuable compared to even just a little bit of structure, taking someone into a living room setting, giving them a proper sit-down play session, watching them without being observed and by a crowd, and you prompting them with questions, adds a huge amount of value. Although, I guess, as we've talked about, much earlier on, as you said, it really depends on what you want to know.
Yeah.
So there might be, if you've got very specific research questions and you're very careful in how you handle the conference, you might be able to see, can players complete the section without a tutorial, for example. But you have to spend that time deciding what you want to know, making sure you're not biasing that from the setting, and then creating a mini study in that environment, which is very difficult in a high pressure environment like a conference.
It is, and particularly because you've actually got mixed objectives in that setting, and I think that's really the crux of it. I mean, I have got useful information out of those kind of environments, but normally it's where I've been, like I say, very, very clear on what specifically I wanted to understand. Mm-hmm. So, for example, I might know that they're going to be biased, but we specifically want to see how they react to a particular user interface. So how many people can, like you say, finish that level? But what more importantly might be, how do they approach playing the game? Do they touch the screen and swipe left, right, or do they tap? And it's amazing how cleanly differentiating it can be. If you've got something discrete like that, you can check that isn't about whether they enjoy the game or not, but is more about how do they actually tackle the experience as presented. And I think looking for those tests that are relevant, where there is a clean way to differentiate that's independent of the context, then I think you can do some interesting in research elements. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. Exactly. Focusing on your objective, making sure you're getting reliable data for that objective can be done in these settings.
And equally, getting people into their living room to play a game obviously isn't happening right now. Well, hope not. well, hopefully we'll get back to it soon. But anyway, that's why I find the movement to online has been really powerful personally.
There's a whole bunch of tools. You've already mentioned Playtest Cloud and Antidote. Yeah. Which are good for unmoderated testing, as in you've given them a build, they're testing by themselves, and you get a video back. Screen sharing tools make it possible to do some sort of moderated testing where you are you're watching live so that you can ask questions about the behavior you're seeing as you see it, which is also really valuable. I'm also haven't used a huge amount, but there's Parsec, which I know a lot of publishers are using currently.
Oh, I don't know that.
Which, so one of the challenges with running remote sessions is that you have to get the build to them, and if they don't have the development console or the right spec laptop, it's hard for them to get the build to test.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
Parsec allows you to stream from your device. I guess it's the same as Google Stadia, but it allows you to stream from your device to their home. Obviously, there's a degree of lag. You have to be aware of that in the conclusions you're taking. But for some genres of game, that overcomes some of the technical issues with getting a build to someone remotely.
Yeah. No, that's great. I didn't know that was... I'm going to have to check that one out, because that yes. sounds great. I mean, we have tried to do things like that in the past, until I'm old, so I don't think there's much I haven't tried. But it is interesting kind of like seeing that... In fact, I was going to ask you separately. I mean... have you seen people using tools even like Zoom, where you get them to share the screen and you basically talk them through the process? I've actually not tried that. Can that be an effective way to do it?
Yes, and what's really nice about that is Zoom and Google Meet
whatever else. Yeah,
they're either free or the license is affordable to many of these small teams I've been speaking to. So yes, definitely that you can get if. It's a build that they can play on their side. You can get them to install the build and then just screen share them playing it, which is great. You can put some mock-ups or you can put prototypes in front of people through that. Again, that's a really accessible tool. And this is a difficult topic. I was going to say, what's really nice about the pandemic? A significant change because of the pandemic is that it's taught everyone how to do video screen sharing.
Yes.
And so before, you would have had a significant bias that only very technical people would be confident sharing their screen or doing a video call, whereas now people's literacy with video calling is a lot higher, and it's a lot easier to get realistic players to do these kind of remote activities.
And it's absolutely clear that that's had a dramatically positive effect on the games industry as a whole anyway as well. So I think that's not only have they become more game literate, video call literate, but I think they've also become more game literate, and therefore it's become a lot easier in some ways to communicate to a much wider audience of people. I think to me this is the thing, and I think you hinted it earlier about that we're not just talking about playable games here. You know, it's amazing how much benefit you can get by asking people questions before you even get to it. And I've been particularly influenced of late by the hyper-casual scene. Now, what they're tending to do is creating a video before they even create the game, and then getting feedback, real data, hard data, from doing these kind of Facebook ads I was mentioning earlier. But there's no reason why you can't use the same kind of principle of here is a art style, here is concept, something which I think we in the AAA side of things have been doing for a long time, because they tend to have a lot larger budgets and therefore have a lot more scope. To be able to do that kind of assessment of what, how appealing, how attractive, what style, what genres are going to work, how the chemistry of a design idea feels even before you make it. Do you see that there's, how reliable do you think it is to do those kind of very early things? How much of that actually comes out well in the end, do you think?
This is a really touchy subject. Perhaps you've experienced how much of a touchy subject it is.
Which is why I'm raising it.
So, as a games user researcher, one of the distinctions we make is that we believe we're different to market research. Market research is a lot of that work of, do you think this is a nice idea? Does it look like fun? Do you like this art? Those type of questions. And obviously that's a really important part of making a successful game. One of the challenges that we have, because art is an artistic medium and we're working with designers who are very creative and have a very strong vision, is that if we're not careful, they might see what user research is doing as trying to change their creative vision or eliminate the art, artistic part of it, and just make mass market commercial things that aren't the reason why people get into games. Because of that, as user researchers, we draw a very strong distinction between what we try and do with our studies is to first understand your vision and then help you realize your vision. So there's often an interpretation gap between what you think you're putting in the world and what a player's experiencing, and we want to remove that gap, but we don't want to change your the thing you're trying to make.
Yes.
However, that distinction between what we do of helping you realize your vision and what a market researcher would do of helping you decide what would be a profitable game to make can be quite blurry.
Yeah.
Might be academic to anyone who isn't a user researcher. It might just be us who care so much about this, but it's certainly an interesting topic.
And the reason I raise it is because I was trained as a marketeer. Mm-hmm. So I started in that marketing camp, and I did do a lot of user research as part of that process, but that's a separate thing. Market research and user research are, like you say, discreetly different things. Mostly in purpose rather than technique, I would argue. Mm. Although there are some, user research gets much more in the weeds of what people functionally do. And I also think that I look at things from the point of view of the marketing data, the user behavior data, but also the kind of not just what they say they do and what you observe they do, but what they actually do. Mm-hmm. In terms of gameplay data, which I love data in every form, but they are different flavors. You know, what you get from a user research process is not the same as you get from observing real players playing live. Mm-hmm. And I think you've got to be able to take that data and understand how that applies to the feedback you get from taking someone through a test process compared to the feedback you get from when you talk about the ideas of the game. Mm-hmm. I often talk about how these net promoter scores and the kind of usability testing we've been talking about is more about the why, whereas the kind of how, or how's not really the right word, but let's use how for now. How people actually play is not necessarily the same as the why. And I think you need both pieces to be able to decide what to do. A marketing research is slightly different because it's more of a contextual thing, I think. Mm-hmm. It's the ambition. It's the it's not just about viability, or viability is part of it. Anyway, the reason I go on about that is because I think the first thing I was taught on my first day in my marketing course was marketing is understanding and satisfying consumer needs. Mm. Now, whether that's a language everybody uses, I don't know, but that's a language that really sunk home with me. And it's really a language of product management in the widest traditional sense. So product management is about creating experiences for users, essentially at the heart of it. Now, obviously, when I say product, I mean service. People can, you know, argue with me over the differences, but I think creating a service that people want to use is an incredibly critical thing to do. And I think as we become, as we look at the kind of the scale of the games industry now can achieve, you know, $150 billion industry or something, according to Newsday, you know, we've seen this massive transition that I think has largely been fueled by data. But I think we're now at a stage where brand is becoming more and more important. I mean, it's always been important, but it's becoming more important in different ways. So much so, I think that the balance is shifting from the not the creator led. We're always going to be creator led. We're always going to be needing the people with the artistic skills and the creativity and the design skills. But for them to be informed by the marketing research process as much as they're informed by the usability process, as much as they're informed by their gut feel and history and legacy of what makes a good game. And I think it's a good thing if we can take all these things. But even though I'm saying all this stuff, I think we still have a situation where there's a load of emotional focus on the legacy and history. I think we're still a little bit behind the curve in understanding, well, some studios are behind the curve in understanding that even usability testing is an important part of understanding, getting insight to what makes the game work.
I think that's definitely true. If you look outside of games to more general tech, there's a great understanding of usability testing is obviously essential and a really core part of what we work, but it's only part of what we're doing, as well as the market research we talked about. Also understanding user needs and working out what are the context of play and what the challenge they have, and positioning our things as a solution to the problems that users really have. And a lot of that thinking hasn't got very far in the games industry. There's the there's the fear, I guess, that any sort of input from players will conflict with artistic vision or creative visions. Yeah. And because of that, it has an impact on all of these things we talked about: market research, usability testing, understanding user needs, or even just informal playtesting can meet some resistance because we think it's in conflict with the auteur method of making things.
I think there's so many things wrong with the auteur method of doing things. But, you know, what do I know? I'd much rather we think about the band than we think about the lead singer. Mm-hmm. But then I'm biased. I've always been at the back of the band, cheering them on. I'm the dancer. I'm Bez. I'm the Bez of the band. I have had no value whatsoever except wearing a nice hat. It's not true, hopefully. But my point though is, I think we're growing up a little bit though about that model, mm-hmm. though. I think that when you look at some of the amazing experiences, and what's got me thinking as you were talking is thinking about the experiences. Let's take a Fall Guys or something like that. What's, mm-hmm. I think, emerged out of those kind of experiences, how important it is, not just for the player, but for the person the player is watching play. Mm. So I think as we're evolving into an industry, we're becoming a medium that is a backdrop as much as it is the objective. I think watching content creators on YouTube, Twitch, etc. playing games as a key thing that we see and experience, and I've forgotten the stat exactly, but I think more people watch live video game streaming than Netflix.
Oh,
something
wow.
like that. Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, video game content in general is more than Netflix, HBO, you know, all the main channels, Amazon Prime, all these kinds of stuff combined.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just the nature of the beast. So that compared to when I first joined the industry in 98, where there was some TV shows in South Korea showing live games of StarCraft, but that was it. That was the only form of using watching game players. It's an amazing, amazing change. And so I'm wondering, you know, where does the usability research come into that? Because I think we're looking at usability from a player point of view. How much are people thinking about not just the usability part, but the enjoyability of watching the user? Is that something we're testing?
I think that's really nice. And yeah, I've seen very little work done on it, but I agree with you entirely. It's such a huge and growing medium that applying all those user research methods that we talked about from tech would be very relevant. Let's understand what are people trying to achieve when they're watching these things? What are their needs? What's difficult about watching them currently? You could create a very successful viewing experience. I think I don't know the area very well, so this might be misattributed. I think there's a paper by University of Waterloo in Canada. Or University of Ontario, they'll be offended, whichever one it wasn't. it's the only thing I've seen in this space of trying to look at the observer experience. But yeah, I think it's a huge growth area. I think you've identified a really important area there.
I think this is something that we all have to think about. I think increasingly, it's become a pretty obvious with the Among Us Fall Guys kind of like shared social experience. I think we know that's a thing. But even when we look at some of the kind of like... the games that wouldn't necessarily be there. You know, there's so many of the games that have become big hits because some streamer decided to push that game. Mm-hmm. But I think even in mobile, we've seen that. And I actually remember with the guys at Seriously, when they got people like PewDiePie, but who, you know, obviously was huge at the time, but they hadn't been used for promoting games. Mm-hmm. And with Best Fiends, getting a group of YouTubers to promote it was unheard of. Mm. I got a couple of mates of mine and at Seriously who did a brilliant, inspirational job that I think even to this day is an abject lesson for game developers to think about. But of course, getting somebody of that caliber is increasingly hard and expensive. But I think that that just means that we have to be smarter and we have to look at what is going to get that. Because one of the stats I'd like to research when I do a game is how can my game give more audience for the YouTubers that we want to engage with it? Because if I can get more audience for YouTubers because they play my game, then the YouTubers are going to play my game, I would hope.
It's not exactly analogous, but all of these things are design problems that game designers can design for, right? The success of Wordle over the last month, again, it's not a streaming game, but a lot of its success is based on the social sharing and the design features that have been created by the designer that have led to massive success. And again, these are just design challenges that game designers can and should be thinking about.
And that's what I'm coming round to saying is that, I mean, when I look at a game, and I say this all the time, I look at a game in terms of its mechanic. So the start condition, the challenge, the resolution, the reward, that's easy to test. We understand how that is testable in a testing experience. Then I look at the context loop. So the context loop for me is like the purpose of progression, unfinished business, the game economy, the narrative, that kind of stuff. But then when I look at the metagame, for me, the metagame, which is my third layer, is about social integration. It's about cultural zeitgeist. It's about mode of use. Now, I think mode of use, as in how functionally we engage with the device and how it fits into our lifestyle, those are pretty measurable. But when we get into social connection and social engagement and social sharing, I think they're a lot harder to test with usability test type structures. Am I wrong? I mean, is there an obvious way to deal with that, or is it something you think is still emerging?
I think it's not a usability test, but there is a lot, again, looking outside to tech, that outside of games, tech research is doing equivalent things. So doing ethnographic research and observation about people in their real context in the real world gives you that kind of rich data and rich inspiration that you, if you were designing these features, would need to do it. So, yeah, again, it's an area where in games user research, it hasn't been promoted that much or hasn't been that relevant in the past. But a lot of work is being done out in general tech in this area that I think game designers can look to if they're interested in exploring it, and they should be.
Yeah, I agree, totally agree. It's something, as you can probably tell, I'm constantly thinking about these kind of things. So but that's part of the joy of being a strategy officer, or as we like to call me, the chief of curiosity. So, to sum it up, what's the sort of one bit of advice you would give? And I think it's probably worth separating out from the small indie and the kind of medium-sized game developer. What's the one piece of advice you'd give each of those people that if they're considering usability testing?
So I'm going to give the same advice twice to both, but I'm going to give a double piece of advice. I think treat usability testing, user research as an iterative process, and do it quickly and or do it simply and early would be my recommendation. You could get hung up all day on thinking about how do I run this giant survey, or how do I get exactly the right kind of players, and those are important questions, but you get a huge amount of value just from getting started and then reflecting on that process and then doing it better the next time. And so from the earliest thing you have, whether it's a playable prototype, whether it's earlier than that, as we've talked about, exposing that to players, putting them through some scenarios to see their behavior and their opinions, reflecting on what you've learned and making changes, I think you can't go wrong with that as a game development process. And so for all these studios, I think just giving it a go is a good start.
No, I completely agree. I'd add cheaply as well. The reason I say cheaply is because you can always do it again. Exactly. You spent all the money the first time, you can't.
Yes, yeah, exactly. Iteratively is the important thing, isn't it? It's like, give it a go. Don't put all your eggs in one giant basket at the end of production and do one big play test where you've learned it's all gone wrong. Actually, lots of small things throughout and it'll go fine.
And I mean, from just a context for us, what we do, these CPI tests, so we basically do a 30-second trailer of what the game looks like. We put it on a Facebook ad, and then we see how many people install the game. If we've got a game, we'll see what day one retention looks like straight away. And we'll spend 150 quid, so £50 a day for 3 days. That's it. And we get a whole bunch of data out of it. If we've got game analytics built into the game, if we built that, then we get a whole bunch more data for that same amount of money, tiny amounts of money. It's not perfect, but it allows us to get a sense of how the game is likely to perform.
And comparing 150 quid to the cost of spending a couple of weeks working on something that isn't going to work out, it's a huge saving, isn't it? The opportunity cost, the staffing cost, just doing small things early is a tremendous time saver and money saver.
And it's been really big learning curve. And I have to thank the hyper casual industry. However, I know not everyone's a fan of it. I get that. But I think people make the mistake that they think that hyper casual is just about getting money from ads. It's actually about making the cheapest way of making games possible, in my opinion. And I think if you think about it that way, it completely changes your way of looking at games. And you can apply that technique to anyone. So find data as early as possible, as cheaply as possible, as reliably as possible, and iterate. And I think that really, to me, like you said, iteration is the key there. So, Steve, thank you so much for that. It's been fantastic fun for me. And I love talking about this subject, as I'm sure you can tell. I love talking about game development in general, obviously. Otherwise, I wouldn't be doing a podcast on it. But enough about me. Tell everybody how they can get hold of you. What's your social media handle of choice?
Yes. So I guess the first place is on Twitter. I'm at Steve_Bromley. Also, I have a website, which is stevebromley.com, which has links to everything I do. I send a monthly email newsletter educating people about how to run playtests and how to do games user research. And if you're interested in the subject we talked about today, that's a really great next step for this kind of thing.
Great stuff. Steve, thank you so much. That's been great. So this has been your Game Dev London podcast, he says, switching into the mode. And I've been your host. I've been Oscar Clark. And we're going to be talking more about everything you want to know about game dev as we do more podcasts. So thank you very much, everybody, for taking part and listening to us. I hope it was interesting. If it was, let us know and let everybody else know. If it wasn't, let me know and we'll work out the rest later. So thank you very much, folks. And that's been us.